Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you guys for joining us. Wrestle Kingdom 14 just ended. This is our Wrestle Kingdom 14 post-game show. And as I'm going to call it today, it is Breakfast with Wrestling Inc. I am your host for today, Michael Wiseman, joined by our resident New Japan Pro Wrestling expert, Jesse Collings. Jesse, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great. I was tired, but it was definitely a great weekend of shows. Really interesting. A lot of stuff happened. I'm excited to talk about it today, this morning, tonight, wherever you are.
There's just like this weird, like, I have no idea what time it is right now and kind of what's going on. And
It is a bit of an adventure, and it really makes you appreciate the, you know, European fans and fans in the UK, because when they want to watch shows in America, which all WWE shows or most other major promotions, it's on in the middle of the night for them all the time. So I feel I definitely sympathize with them. It's fun to do maybe once a year, or in this case, twice a year, but any other time of year, I don't think I'd be up to do it.
Yeah, that's a really great point, because I think we take for granted here stateside. WWE is the prominent, other than maybe New Japan Pro Wrestling, right? Is the premier pro wrestling organization in the entire world. And we get the luxury of watching it on a Saturday night or a Sunday night and not having to stay up late like we do tonight. And this puts into focus that, yeah, guys, this being up in the middle of the night to watch wrestling takes a lot of dedication. So if you get up in the middle of the night for WWE pay-per-views, number one, I'm impressed. Number two, don't do it. What was your, like, how did you get ready to do this? Right. Cause this was 2 days. If you're just joining us, hopefully you watched Wrestle Kingdom 14. Let me put this out there right now. Hopefully you watched it, because we're going to get into all the match details, everything we can cram into the next hour. There will be spoilers for everything. So if you've not watched it yet, please go watch it. If you have watched it and you happen to be up with us watching live, we do have a live chat going on YouTube right now. You can check that out on the Wrestling Geek YouTube page, where we're going to have live chat going throughout the next hour. But if you are doing breakfast with us and you stayed up late, Jesse, I got to ask you, how did you prepare for these 2 days of staying up late, or getting up early, depending, because you're East Coast too, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm a natural night owl, so staying up that late, I don't usually stay up till like 8 a.m. It wasn't that challenging for me last night, especially because I didn't have anything to do Saturday, so. Sure. It wasn't that big of a deal. A Sunday I have, or I guess today I have like beer plans. I'm going out around midday. So, that's going to be a little bit more challenging. Right now I'm doing fine. Ask me Sunday night, ask me Monday when I'm supposed to be at work and I'm probably asleep at my desk. That will be a bigger challenge, but, I famously don't drink coffee or tea and don't have any caffeine in my system. And I'm regretting that life choice at this point, but we'll see how it goes.
That is very impressive. I just showed up. John P says, I feel like a zombie. And John P, I 100% agree. I cheated yesterday. I watched day one Saturday afternoon, or Saturday morning-ish, afternoon-ish, once I got up, because we weren't doing this show until after today. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, we're on the East Coast here. This show started at midnight. The pre-show did. The broadcast started at 1 for the proper card. And yeah, so I tried to go to sleep at like 8 and get a few hours of sleep before we did this, and I'm going to try to get some sleep afterwards. But I'm not a night owl like you. I like my typical go to bed at 11, get up at 7 kind of routine for sleep. So this has been a challenge for me. I do have my coffee. Luckily, this card was incredible from top to bottom. And so many things to get into in the next hour. We're going to get into every match a little bit. Some matches more than others, but a ton of big, huge matches with big, huge implications. But the first thing that sticks out to me, Jesse, is these cards emanating from Japan. We both watched. You watched it on Fight as well, right?
Oh, no, I watched it on New Japan World.
You watched it on New Japan. Okay, so yeah. How was your experience with New Japan World in the stream situation tonight?
So on night one, it was fine. Night two, it was a tiny bit choppy, and they even had a little notice up on my screen saying due to demand or due to traffic, they're experiencing some delays. I didn't really experience any like buffering issues, but there were some times where the video quality went down, and it was it was a good experience. I mean, it was about what I normally see on New Japan World. I don't know. How was your experience on Fight?
Fight was great. And Fight, yeah. I got to give Fight some props here. They hooked us up with some codes we got to give out to some people that follow us on Wrestling Geek on Twitter and such. So really appreciate their support here. So I did watch it on Fight. I've watched it on New Japan in the past. I like Fight because it's a little bit easier to get into the app on Roku or whatever. And honestly, both days, my stream was really solid. There's a couple of audio dropouts. I think that was the result of stuff happening in the Tokyo Dome. And we'll get into that in a little bit. But I did not have any of the streaming issues that I think people watching a New Japan World maybe had this morning. Some people said it dropped out for the first part of the card, things like that. So did not experience any of that. But it is a very different kind of broadcast. Like if you are a new pro wrestling fan getting into New Japan Pro Wrestling, I should say, it's a very, I would call it almost a Spartan kind of broadcast, right? That doesn't have all the razzmatazz that a WWE show has. Everything's still in Japanese. I got to give props here. I think the commentary team for New Japan is fantastic. Kevin Kelly does a bang-up job. Yes, Kevin Kelly, if you don't know, the guy from WWE 20 years ago, right, works for New Japan, does an amazing job. Of course, he had Gino with him there. Rocky Romero joined them for parts of the show. And I thought the commentary team helped make this a very approachable show for a Western audience.
The commentary team in New Japan is, and tonight and the last two nights was great. I really can't overstate how important they are to the overall show of the product. When I first started watching New Japan, they didn't have the English commentary. Yeah. It was only in Japanese. And I actually grew to like it, even though I didn't really understand what they're saying, but they were really over the top with their enthusiasm. So it was kind of fun to watch. And I said, when they added the English commentary, I was like, I'm not going to watch that. I like the Japanese commentary, right? That kind of hardcore idea. But slowly I started.
You're the guy that like, you don't want to, you don't watch with dub. You never watch anything dubbed, right? You're the subtitle dude.
Yeah. I mean, but I never wanted to watch the English commentary, and then I slowly started to get into it. And then I realized, and I was like, damn, these guys are really good. And they helped so much with this broadcast. I mean, we could talk about it at other times. I thought one of the best things was in the Will Ospreay, Hiromu Takahashi match. Very early in the match, they mentioned, oh, you know, Hiromu's talked about how he's working on something new, which it would be, he has a different finisher than the Time Bomb.
Right.
And then they said that just kind of casually, like, oh, he mentioned he's working on something. When he was out, he was working on something new. So then when he hit the Time Bomb and Ospreay kicked out, you're like, oh, he's got some other crazy finisher he's going to do, which ended up being that Emerald Flosion cradle kind of driver where he basically just dropped Ospreay on his head. And I was like, oh, that was what it was. And it was just like that kind of little stuff. And there was so many different things. And Michael, that was a 4-man booth that you had Kevin Kelly, you had Gino, you had Rocky Romero, and then you had Chris Charlton, who comes in with the translations and does the few history pieces here and there. And yes, that is really difficult, a 4-person booth. We complain on WWE when they have a 3-person booth, and AEW to a degree too. Like sometimes it doesn't always work, 3 people, it's too many people. This was 4, and it worked pretty flawlessly. I think you got to give a lot of credit to Kevin Kelly for being kind of the point man and making sure everyone was involved and kind of being the main guy to set up everyone. It was very impressive with the commentary. I think it helps a lot for people who don't know that much about the product, but also for someone like myself who follows it pretty closely, it still adds so much. It's not just for beginners. They do a really good job. It's very underrated.
Absolutely. And I've always said, I mean, a couple of years ago, or last year, they were showing it on Access TV and you had Jim Ross in the booth. And I said, don't watch that version. Watch the new, this was before Fight, watch the New Japan World version because you got Kevin Kelly. And again, I think he does this great job. You mentioned the entire team. They all do a great job. But Kevin Kelly, especially telling that story for a Western audience, he's so good at it, so adept at it. And just the little things like you mentioned, I mean, constantly giving us stats throughout the night. So-and-so won this many matches last year. So-and-so hasn't won any match in the Tokyo Dome in this long. How many victories they've had. And AEW does this with their win and loss record, but the way they conveyed it at the beginning of matches and tied it into the story, all the props in the world to that Wrestle Kingdom 14 American commentary team.
It feels like you're watching a regular, like a real sport.
It does.
Because absolutely, they have data, like the way they would talk about, you know, rushing yards or something like that. In football, they would talk about, you know, or, you know, turnover differential or something like that. It goes along with the whole idea that with New Japan and Japanese wrestling in general is presented more as a realistic sport as opposed to the kind of more entertainment that we get in America. And I think that goes back to the commentary as well.
100%. And to your point, the stats they use are relevant to either that unique wrestler or kind of what story they have going on. And here in America, they give us stats sometimes, but it always feels like to me they're giving us, this person's been a 15-time world champion.
Yeah, it's like a worked stat. It's, yeah. You know, it doesn't, I mean, it's all work stats, but it's always kind of like, oh, this person did this. And, you know, this time's a champion and this person held the title for this days and Raw's longest running episodic television series in history or whatever the stat they use for that. But it's helpful to have that.
We'll get into some of the other kind of commentary and broadcast differences as we dive into some of these matches. But I think we had, I want to say, how many matches between both nights? 12 or 14 matches total. Well,
it depends if you count the gauntlet matches as individual matches.
Yeah, and so this is the difference between New Japan 2 and what we have here in America, which is New Japan does open up a lot of multi-man matches. Of course, we get to WrestleMania season. We're right here on the cusp. We're going to see a bunch of multi-man tag matches, get everybody in the show in a ladder match, that kind of stuff happening at WrestleMania. New Japan does that as well for their big Wrestle Kingdom event. Again, this is their WrestleMania of the year. But they do it for the first part of the show and save the singles matches for the latter part of the show. And it really does build in a nice way. So I think, again, a difference in the way they book their cards. So day one kicked off. We had this this really big multi-man match to kick everything off here for their pre-show, which is very different than the WWE pre-show. But we had Iwatani and Arisha Hoshiki defeating Kimura and Yulia. A tag team stardom special match, a very quick match here, went about 9 minutes. It was pretty good. But then I think the more interesting opening match here, we had the great Bash heel losing, or did they win that match? This is now, it's been so many matches now, I'm forgetting this. Did they win or lose against Tohinari, Fredericks, Connors, and Coughlin?
Good question.
This is one of the pre-show matches we had going on.
Well, the first pre-show match, the women's match, was not actually shown on New Japan World.
Right.
It was very kind of controversial because that's a stardom match. And it was the first women's match to be on a New Japan card in, I think, almost 20 years. And one of the only times in history. And they actually couldn't show that on New Japan World because the reason for that is that even though Stardom was recently acquired by Bushiroad, which is the parent company for New Japan Pro Wrestling, New Japan World is partially owned by TV Asahi, which is the television network that New Japan is on in Japan. And Stardom is on a rival television station. And TV Asahi basically was like, you guys can't show another network's promotion on the streaming service. So we actually didn't see the Stardom match on New Japan World. And so that was, that was a kind
this
of
this was the Iwatani and Hoshiki match defeating Kimura and Yulia. Yes.
Yes, it was the women's match. And there was some controversy with that. It was just kind of a quick match. We didn't see it. What I heard in the building was that it didn't get over that big, but it wasn't booed at all or anything like that. But it'll be interesting to see how their relationship with Stardom continues. It's going to be tough if they can't show it on New Japan World. But regardless, the match after that, which was the Young Boys match, taking on Great Bash Heel along with a couple other New Japan young boys, the LA Dojo guys, the Americans, right. Alex Coughlin, Clark Connors, Carl Fredericks, and then along with Toa Hanari, they actually won that match. And that was the second dark match, but the first one we, the viewers at home, actually got to see.
Yeah.
And then following that, you had another dark match. It was Hiroshi Tenzin and Satoshi Kojima. They beat Manabu Nakanishi and Yuji Nagata. These are all guys who were big stars in the 90s. And are now in their 40s, and their work, some of them guys have aged better than others, but it was just kind of your basic, it's kind of like how they use their legends to a degree. They kind of use them. They're around, they're on like kind of preliminary matches, but you rarely see these guys kind of crack into the main event. It's just kind of how they use the older guys as, and we'll get into that with how they use Liger later, but they don't necessarily, you know, in WWE, the older guys would be in the main event.
Right, exactly. These guys are kind of setting up the card and giving fans a taste of what to come. And I love talking about the women's match here and how this kind of came from this partnership with Stardom. And to me, that's the one thing we talk about in New Japan broadcast and how great these 2 days of wrestling were. The thing that I still miss is we do not have a women's division here for New Japan Pro Wrestling. And so, to me, that's a miss for this product as they kind of continue to branch out and hopefully find a more American audience here.
Yeah, well, it's very political. In Japan, historically, it's been very separate. You have your women's promotions and your men's promotions. And the all women's promotions historically have been extremely popular. There have been times in history where the women's promotions outdrew many of the men's promotions. There's multiple all women's promotions in Japan beyond just Stardom that are very successful. And it's not seen as in Japan as being in America. It's almost seen as like you have to do it. You have like as a rite of passage. We've seen it with all the AEW, Ring of Honor adding women. Obviously, Impact's had women for a long time. WWE as well. In Japan, it's not seen as that big of a deal. Now, that could be a cultural difference between American fans expect to see women's wrestling on their product. In Japan, it's kept very separate, and that's something that's going to be kind of like a East versus West kind of mentality when it comes to New Japan. And we figure out, well, if they want to recruit American fans, they might have to include more women's matches because that's what American fans expect. But at the same time, historically, the tradition is separate promotions.
Yeah, and that's very similar to the way we run major sport leagues here, right? Japan is the major pro wrestling league there. And to us, it's like, oh, WWE is all of professional wrestling. Well, no, but we still have a separate women's NBA versus a men's NBA. We still have separate divisions and all that stuff in NCAA. And so, yeah, it kind of makes sense if you, like, to your point, they treat it more like a real
just
sport.
It's just a different mentality. I mean, I don't think there's a right or wrong way to do it. In Japan, I mean, you could say, oh, well, the women should have the opportunity to be on the show. But the argument for that is, well, if you want to support women's wrestling, you go to the all women's promotions.
Yeah.
If New Japan wanted to start a women's promotion, you could, or a women's division within the promotion, you could actually argue that'd be unhealthy for women's wrestling in Japan because you'd be taking the best talent away from these successful all women's promotions.
Yes, absolutely. So we get into the main card here. And of course you mentioned this earlier, this is kind of using a bunch of legends here, but the main important part of this opening bout was the fact that this was the first of Justin Thunder Liger's two retirement matches, right? And so we have an 8-man tag team match here. Justin Thunder Liger being the main focus of kind of what's happening here. But Justin Thunder Liger and his team, they lose to the likes of Sano Otani, Takaiwa, and Taguchi. And I think it's an interesting thing. Of course, here in America, we talk about our legends and putting them over here. What stood out to me about all of this in this multi-man match was how respectful everybody was to Jushin Thunder Liger and what he means to the business.
Yeah, I mean, Liger, you could argue in America, with the exception of maybe like Antonio Inoki, Liger's probably the most famous Japanese wrestler to American fans. Maybe Great Muda too, but Liger's someone that even I would say that even if you know, if you're a fan of wrestling in America, even if you know nothing about Japanese pro wrestling, chances are you know who Liger is. And this was, a part of a year-long storyline where he's going to retire. So the first match was this 8-man tag where it was basically a bunch of people who Liger had been had rivalries with, who he had tagged with. I was actually impressed because a lot of these guys are really old. And while, like, facially they looked old, a lot of them were in, like, pretty good cosmetic shape beyond that. And a lot of them, there was, like, some real, like, spots done in this match, which when you consider these are a bunch of these were a bunch of old people who had wrestled an extremely athletic style for 20 or 30 years. The fact that a lot of them could still do moves was impressive. I mean, on Liger's team, he had Tatsumi Fujinami, who was Liger's idol when Liger was a teenager. And Liger's over 50 years old, and Fujinami, I believe, is 66 years old. And Fujinami didn't do a lot. He just kind of did his dragon screw leg whip, but they kind of fed him, but he still looked good doing it. So I was impressed by how these guys have aged. And then, of course, Liger lost. He took the pinfall, which was surprising. But in Japan, the veteran guy who's going out, he's retiring, he does the job to Taguchi, who's still active, with the idea being, well, I'm going to put over someone who's going to be still wrestling on a regular basis.
It's that whole idea of respect, which is so central and ingrained in the Japanese wrestling culture. And that loss right there signifies a lot, not only to the guy who is losing here and going away, which is Jushin Thunder Liger, but to the person who picks up the win. And there were some other great talents in here. On Liger's team, we had guys like Fujinami, the great Sasuke, Tiger Mask. Of course, there's a storied history there with Tiger Mask, and El Samurai was on the sidelines there.
Yeah, it was a lot of big. It was a lot of big names, and I mean, Fujinami is a bigger star in Japan than Liger. I mean, he's not as big of a star to us because Fujinami didn't wrestle that much in the U.S. Although I think he did wrestle Ric Flair in the main event of a WCW pay-per-view in 1993. But and we see the comment Doom Trap T saying Fujinami looked incredible for his age. I thought like he still had like a muscle definition, which I was like unbelievable for a guy that old. I was really impressed, even though he didn't really take any bumps. But I mean, it was like a big kind of like all these legends kind of just being. And I think Fujinami after the match said that like he was really proud of what Liger had become, and it's like oh, that's so nice. Fujinami said that about Liger because Liger always looked up to Fujinami. But it was really junior heavyweight royalty in Japan.
Absolutely. And Doom Trap points out here, Fujinami looked great for his age. Can't lose sight of the fact that most of you American fans who do know Liger probably picked him up in the early 90s. He came over, wrestled in WCW. I know at the time for me, I was a young wrestling fan and it was really cool. Of course, I'm wearing a Power Rangers hat for the podcast tonight. But part of the reason is because Liger came over and represented something about Japanese culture that we here in America didn't see a whole lot, right? This very flamboyant style, not eccentric, but just very colorful, very bright, very high flying, very quick. And something you saw throughout a lot of Japanese culture that we got in snippets, right? I'm a big Power Rangers fan because I watched it growing up, and I found out later how steep that was in a variety of other things from Japanese entertainment. So Liger represents a lot to American audiences from that perspective if you followed him since he was in WCW.
Yeah, I mean, the Jushin Liger character is based off of a manga. Yeah. And his intro music is the music from the anime series that he had. So he's definitely like, yeah, you're right. That's a good point that he not only was he unique because of his wrestling style was pretty much unseen in US when he came on, but also the kind of Japanese culture that he kind of brought with him as far as what we would later become much more mainstream in America.
So we followed up with another 8-man tag match here. We had Suzuki Gun defeating we had Sonata. This was a stacked match here. A ton of great talent we would see on both days. Sonata, Evil, Takagi, and Bushi. And the big thing here being that Zack Sabre Jr. picked up the victory by submission. And I really liked Zack Sabre Jr. in this, knowing that he was going to come back on day two. And we'll talk more about that match here in a minute and wrestle again. This match was really setting up the showdown that he would have on night two going up against Sonata. And so I like the fact that, number one, Zack Sabre Jr. picked up the win via submission. Number two, at the end of the match, Sonata was kind of staring him down. But there's also this detail here. Here in America, when somebody goes to break up something, I can just do a loose kick or a loose punch, right? And whatever you're doing just gets let go. If there's a pin attempt, if I just land on you with my right hand, that pin attempt is over. But in New Japan, Zack Sabre Jr. had this submission still locked in after the match. They're calling for the bell. And Sonata had to kick him multiple times and then pull him off to break it up. And it adds to this element of realism, I think, that you really do get from the style of wrestling, this quote-unquote strong style we see in New Japan.
Yeah, and one of the things about these 8-man tag match, first of all, they're done to kind of get everyone on the card, for starters. But with the kind of with this year being back-to-back shows, you kind of got like, it was kind of like a preview match for, it got you more into the match the following night because you saw them kind of have this exchange. I kind of joked after night one, I was like, man, that was the greatest go home show in wrestling history, because it kind of was like, it just was kind of was around just to set up night two. And I thought both with this tag team match and that's the one that followed it, the other 8-man tag. Well, yeah, I got everyone on the card. It did kind of help set up some key matches. Obviously, you had this one was the Sonata and the Sabre Jr. match, and then the next match, which I don't think we really need to talk about that much, but it was another 8-man tag. It was the Chaos, Haruki Goto, Tomohiro Ishii, Toru Yano, and Yoshihashi. They beat the Bullet Club team of Bad Luck Fale, Chase Owens, Kenta, and Yujiro Takahashi. And that was kind of to set up really the Kenta versus Haruki Goto match, which would take place the next night. So there were kind of like little hype matches in addition to just being the 8-man tag matches. And then after that, we kind of moved on to what would be considered more of the main card with the title matches.
Yeah, well, I think it's a great point. This night one, especially the first half, really did feel like the ultimate go-home show in pro wrestling history.
Yeah, I mean, the matches were fine, but if I was to recommend, if you hadn't watched Wrestle Kingdom yet, I would say that unless you're really, really interested in getting like the full New Japan experience, or if you just want to see good matches, you can basically skip everything up until the US title match on this show on night one. It's kind of just kind of preview stuff.
100% agree. We have people still in the chat room. This is the importance of Liger here, pouring out their love for him, giving us these comments about how important he is to them and the moments they remember for him. So yeah, still again here, Liger going and retiring after these 2 days is really important here. All these 8-man tag matches, and even this tag team match for the IWGP Tag Team Championship, really were, to your point, setting up night two. I do want to point out here, this Chaos versus Bullet Club match was the first of what felt like Bullet Club really taking it on the chin throughout these two nights, right? It was brought up on night two. Bullet Club lost a lot of matches, and this kind of set the tone for that. And of course, Kenta being involved in this match as well would lose again the next day. So interesting storytelling over both days, and I really like that. But let's talk about this IWGP Tag Team Championship match for just a minute here. Finjuice, I love what they're doing. Of course, Gorillas of Destiny, Tama Tonga, Tongaloa have been great champions. They are great talents. They'll be a great talent stateside if they ever come back over here, which I think we will see them. But Finjuice, they've really found something special with Juice Robinson and David Finlay.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to be an interesting tag team. Tag teaming is one of like the at least the heavyweight tag division is kind of one of the weak points of New Japan. That's what a lot of people feel criticized of how Gato's booked the promotion, is that tag teams aren't taken super seriously, and there hasn't been a ton of depth to the division. The Gorillas of Destiny have been around for a long time.
Sure.
And so kind of getting Juice Robinson and David Finlay on that level is good. Juice was kind of, it was kind of odd for Juice because he had the U.S. title next night. He was kind of in two separate unrelated title matches on back-to-back nights. But I think him and Finlay as a tag team is a good spot for both of them to be. Finlay's a good talent. He's a fourth-generation wrestler, which I think he's probably the only person. There's probably someone else out there, but I don't know if there's any fourth-generation wrestlers out there until the Randy Orton or the Rocks kids starts wrestling. Right. But it's pretty rare. And but he hasn't really found a good role in New Japan. It's obviously a very difficult promotion to kind of break into because there's so much talent. So I think that's a good, the tag team match, it was okay match. I didn't think it was like the best match on the card or anything like that. And but as the first title match, it kind of felt a little bit more significant, and it was a fine match, and I think they'll be good tag team champions.
Yeah, all these matches too, in these early cards, they don't try to steal the show, right? WWE, you might open up with a world title match, and they'll try to steal the show, which is strange. But here in New Japan, it's almost like they know the pecking order, and so the finishes will be a little more standard. This tag match was good, but it wasn't a flashy finish, anything like that.
Yeah, it's a big difference philosophically for how you build your cards. WWE, you know, the first match on the card is usually the second most important match behind the main event, but. And the idea is like we'll have these big matches and then we'll kind of have these lull periods where the crowd will cool down because the crowd can't be hot for 4 hours. But to me, that usually ends to these like random matches that are in between the big matches just dying and nobody reacts to them and they're boring. As opposed to this, it kind of continues to build. And just overall with the pacing of the show, one of the things in New Japan desperately needs is this to be the case, is that they pace the show really well, where they don't have a ton of video packages and promos and in-between stuff. The matches end, and then they kind of move on to the next one. So if you're staying up late and you're watching it, and it's already a 4 or 5 hour show, it doesn't feel quite that long because you're getting most of that as action, as opposed to there being a lot of downtime where you're just kind of looking at your phone or whatever.
Absolutely. We talked about how Spartan these broadcasts are, but some of that's by design, right? They don't have a ton of, they do like little vignettes in between, like the videos. They don't do a whole lot of in-ring mic. They don't conversation. They don't do backstage segments, right? They hit the music and the guy comes down and then there's a brief interlude, but they don't even have match cards that often. They cut to the arena's match cards, but they don't do a whole lot of other stuff, which I think, again, adds to the element of realism. They don't do a whole lot of crowd shots. Every once in a while you get a crowd reaction, but it's not super frequent. And it especially helps, we talk about pacing of the shows. Some of these main event matches are long matches. I mean, this night one main event goes 40 minutes long. Last year we had a match that went, 50? I mean, these matches can go up to 60 minutes long for the time limit draw, and they start off slow to get there. An Okada match, typically, Okada, he goes 15 minutes, a very slow pace. So these cards can get long. These matches can get long. So keeping the pace up helps those lulls in between not feel quite so dramatic. So we had, of course, you mentioned this, the first main match. If you've not watched anything else, check this match out so far. Jon Moxley defeated Lance Archer in this Texas Death Match for the IWGP United States Championship. Lance Archer, for guys who don't know him, if you guys just tune in to see Moxley, you got what you wanted here. But Lance Archer is the guy to me that I think he's a huge talent. New Japan has found a way to really utilize him in the last year. He had that great run last year in the G1 Climax. A dude has the size, has the physique. And while this was not a death match to the standard of what we saw from Kenny Omega and Moxley earlier this year, or Kenny Omega and Joey Janela, it was a different kind of death match, the kind where Lance Archer literally grabbed one of the young lions and threw him, used him as a weapon against Moxley. So I loved this.
Yeah, it was a good match. Archer is really interesting because he's been around forever. He was in TNA for a while. He was in WWE for a brief spell. He was in New Japan for a few years. He was in a tag team, and he kind of broke out last year as a single star. And you look at this guy, I'm like, you know, this guy's 6'7", maybe. Good big guy, just plays the big monster foreign heel. It's a classic role in Japan. There's been one since there was pro wrestling in Japan. So he's been great in that role, and he, you know, held his own. Moxley is a big star, but I thought Archer did really well in this match. And yeah, it was called a Texas Death Match. The rules were more similar to like a last man standing match. It was more like a last man standing match, but there were also submissions. So it was basically you could only win by either having your opponent not respond to a count of 10 winning by submission. So that was kind of the difference between, it wasn't like just a regular like Street Fighter death match, but they would call it the Texas death match. I don't know what made it Texas. Lance Archer's from Texas. That's the difference.
Got to call on the Von Erichs every chance you get here. Right.
So, yeah. And they, it was good. I liked the finishing spot, which was he did the Death Rider.
It's the Dirty Deeds. We can call it the Dirty Deeds.
It's the Death Rider. It's very confusing. It's the Death Rider in New Japan, but it's the Paradigm Shift in AEW. And it's the Dirty Deeds if he goes back to WWE eventually one day. So it's very confusing. But the double arm lifting DDT, he hits it off the apron into the tables. It was a good spot. And I liked that, like, when they cut to Archer and he hadn't responded, he had bladed. So he was bleeding. So you're like, oh, wow, this dude's like really messed up. And that's why he couldn't respond to the 10 count. It kind of sold the idea of like, oh, wow, Moxley really messed him up there with that move. I thought that helped with the finish.
Yeah, absolutely. And so one really small thing here, but it helps. You mentioned the finish here and what that looked like and how that detail added to the brutality of the match. I also got to say again here, Kevin Kelly doing a great job. Archer was going for a spot on the top rope where he's basically doing the Undertaker, right? Where he had Moxley by the arm and he either tripped and fell or it was part of the plan. But a true testament to the talent in this match, which is number one, Moxley immediately reacted and started wailing him with the kendo stick, or maybe he hit him first, but he started hitting him and it felt like it was part of the match, like Archer was supposed to fall right there, which maybe was the intent. But then also Kelly, telling the story here, said he saw Moxley grab the kendo stick out of the corner of his eye, which caused him to fall. So they're giving these guys a reasons for what happened. And it did a really good job all the way around. So love that match. I think, you know, again, Moxley being over there is a unique draw, both because he's an AEW guy, but also because he's a different kind of face. For New Japan Pro Wrestling, it's not the kind of same person you see. These type of matches are different, and it adds to the variety of the card. Of course, as some people said, this is going to be the match of the weekend. We had some really great spots from this. The next matchup was Hiromu Takahashi versus Will Ospreay for the IWGP Junior Heavyweight Championship. And I got to say, dude, this thing had some of the sickest sequences I've seen in a pro wrestling match all year.
I thought this was a genius match. I thought that it had really high expectations. It had a great story with Hiromu coming back from having broken his neck, having been out for a while, now going back for the title. He didn't know what he was really going to look like. He wrestled a reckless style before. Natural to think that he would be very different after he had suffered a very close to career-ending injury. But it turns out he wrestles the exact same style. He's taken all these risks, which maybe isn't good for his long-term health, but as a viewer, I was blown away by this match. Ospreay, I guess I can understand why some people don't like him. I think that night in and night out, he's the best wrestler in the world. If you just watch him, this was the Tokyo Dome. Obviously, he's going to deliver, but if you just watch him on a regular basis, he kind of does this kind of stuff normally, like in front of 1,000 people and not 40,000. But it was just you're right about the sequences. There was the great, like, Ospreay did two Sasuke specials kind of like back-to-back in sequence, but there was also, like, he hit the Sasuke special and then he tried to run back, like, and run over Hiromu, and then they're on the outside and Hiromu gives him, like, a belly-to-belly. And Ospreay, like, instead of, like, would probably crash into the apron, but he's so coordinated that he just kind of like shoots through. It was like a reverse tope. A reverse suicide dive. He like shoots through the ropes into the ring, like rolls into the ring, and then immediately hits the ropes and hits another Sasuke special. And that was, I mean, I've seen a lot of high spots and a lot of everyone, you know, everyone's trying to do the new innovative thing. I've never seen that before. And I was like, wait, what was that? I had a, you know, New Japan World has a little 30-second rewind button. that you can just press, and I'm just like, oh man, I gotta see that again.
Right.
Yeah, I was like, wait, how did that happen? Yeah. But yeah, this was just an awesome match, and it had a great story. And
that would be the gif of the weekend for these two shows, right? Mm-hmm. It's that 30-second sequence you just mentioned over and over and over again. Well, and I know people don't like what they call the quote unquote flippy shit, right? Like people aren't into some people aren't, I should say. But I think what's different here is the speed at which they delivered it in this match, and they still base it around a lot of ground wrestling, that it made it believable. I think when it's like so choreographed, you see this in some indies sometimes where it's like you can tell they know what the next move is going to be, and it doesn't feel there's a natural fluid evolution of the match. Mm-hmm. That's when it feels fake. But I think what Hiromu and Ospreay did here was incredible. And I think it really set Ospreay up for both guys look great. And I think it set Ospreay up for what's going to be now that sequence we mentioned earlier. Ospreay did get injured. It looks like, I don't know the extent of the injury or how long he'll be out.
He hurt his heel, and there's no real known. Will Ospreay also like famously broke his toe and like wrestled like 10 matches over WrestleMania weekend with a broken toe. So I think he's kind of indestructible for the most part. But well, a big thing about this match was that unlike most of the guys on the card, on night one, Ospreay didn't have a match on night two. So he was kind of incentivized to go all out because he knew he didn't have to do anything after, you know, this show, which I think helped him. And also there was that great bit of commentary I pointed out earlier about the mentioning, oh, Hiromu's been working on something else. He's got a different finishing move. And that kind of psychologically got the gears turning in my head. Like, ooh, wonder what it's going to be, because he's probably not going to win with the time bomb, because it would be weird if they teased it and then we didn't see the whatever the new thing was. So I thought everything, like execution-wise, both in the ring and on commentary, this was great. I think it's better. I think this is night one, had two matches on it that were, I can say, legitimately better than any match I saw in 2019.
Mm, wow. That's pretty
high opinion. Yeah. I mean, I was looking
at it. And this is one of them, you think?
Yeah, this is one of them. And then the main event of night one. And I was just like, you know what? I'm like, the match of the year is going to be a really difficult choice for me already. Yeah. And because there's already two great candidates. And I think we probably got a third one on night two. But that was just, I mean, just in my opinion, this was a top tier match you want to see.
Well, Wrestle Kingdom 14 does this to us, or Wrestle Kingdom in general does this. They deliver some of the best matches of the year.
And it's
the very first thing. I also think it's interesting because Ospreay here took the loss, right? Hiromu won. And I also want to call it, I think Hiromu reminds me of like the New Japan Pro Wrestling version of somebody like Dalton Castle, just that flamboyant nature, the kind of gear he wears. And you know what's interesting to me is the kind of gear, like all these, this presentation of New Japan, we've talked about it a lot tonight, but it's different because in WWE, if you are, so let's say, for example, you're The Fiend, you're Bray Wyatt. Mm-hmm. You don't just wear this kind of special gear. That becomes your persona or your character. If you're The Undertaker, WWE wants you to believe you're actually a dead man. But I think we saw numerous cases over these 2 days where in New Japan, you're allowed to be flamboyant. You're allowed to show that artistic side of yourself, wear awesome gear. I mean, Evil coming out earlier in the show with this just incredible gear that just is nothing you'd see. But he's not actually trying to pretend like he's Death, right? It's just part of his presentation about who he comes out, and that he's still a normal person. And I think that's a big difference is New Japan still treats them all like wrestlers, whereas WWE almost sometimes wants you to believe you're watching this invulnerable character doing wrestling.
Yeah, I mean, it's the difference between, you know, costuming and marketing and having a gimmick. And yeah, like Evil has like a little bit of a gimmick, but you're right. He's not being presented as being a dead person. He just kind of like, that's you're supposed to be. You know, he could come out wearing having a giant scythe and wearing a cloak and all that kind of stuff like that. And Hiromu, interesting enough, and this is pretty surprising if you think about Hiromu, it was recently reported, Hiromu is the second biggest merch seller in New Japan behind Okada. So, and you know, Hiromu is a junior heavyweight. He's, you know, he sells, but apparently according to merchandise sales, he sells more merchandise than Naito. He sells more merchandise than Tanahashi. He sells more than Jay White or Kota Ibushi or any of these people, which is pretty interesting from a marketing standpoint because, I mean, New Japan thrives on merchandise sales. Sure. It's not uncommon for them to make more money off of merchandise sales than they do from the gate. You know, they do great per head numbers, and Hiromu is a huge part of that. And he's, you know, there's a great story of him coming back from broken neck and winning the title, obviously. And if he can remain healthy and wrestling the way he does, I hate to say it, but it's questionable if he's going to be healthy for the long haul, but he has a ridiculous amount of potential.
Sure, absolutely. Well, and of course he is obviously New Japan season two. They make him the new champion here, but I want to call out Ospreay too. We talked about the injury. That aside, they're poised, positioning Ospreay up, and he is poised, I think, to have a great run in 2020. They talked about this a lot on commentary, telling the story of how he wants this championship to be the premier championship and for it to be the title that main events Wrestle Kingdom. I don't think that will happen. We're not going to have an IWGP Junior Heavyweight Championship in the main event, but I do think we might see Ospreay have a really good run and maybe have a good shot at the G1 this year.
Yeah, I mean, I think Will Ospreay, if you wanted to make him the IWGP champion by the end of the year, I'm all for that. If you take him, push him as a serious heavyweight, I don't think there's any reason not to do it. He's as good as anyone in wrestling. He's over. He lives in Japan full time, which is key for a foreigner looking to get a big push.
Yep.
So all of that stuff is in his favor. But, you know, it's historically been difficult for junior heavyweights to crack into the heavyweight division. There's been a few guys who have successfully done it, but they're kind of positioned at a different level, and there's kind of nothing there's nothing really wrong being career junior heavyweight. Just sure. Like Liger obviously is a perfect example of that, although he did have a very unmemorable failed heavyweight run in the I think like year 2000. But beside the point, yeah, I mean, Ospreay can do anything. If they ask him to do anything, I feel like he could do anything. I think the elephant in the room for New Japan is that they push, when Kenny Omega left, they pushed Jay White to kind of replace Kenny Omega as like the top foreign guy. And we saw that over these two nights that he's clearly positioned as the top foreigner in the company. But the secret is that Ospreay's way more over than Jay White. Sure. And Ospreay is way more over to Western fans, which is a key part of this whole thing.
Yep.
So I think that's something that they're going to have to figure out. Because if you wanted to give Will Ospreay the Jay White push, and I think Jay White's fine, but I feel like from just a skill standpoint and who's more over, I think Ospreay's better equipped for that role than maybe White is.
Well, and Ospreay is very clearly following in the likes of guys that have come before him who have been mega stars, guys like Kenny Omega, guys like Finn Balor / Prince Devitt. So I think that's the other thing here is it does seem like he's going that same pathway and he is a bigger American, has a bigger name here in America than somebody like Jay White. But let's talk about Jay White because we had this kind of double main event for night one and I think both matches were really fantastic. They both delivered. Of course, the thread here being the winners of both matches would fight on night two. Of course, the losers would fight in a loser. I called it the loser leaves town match. It was not actually a loser leaves town match, but the winners would fight in this double gold dash match to not unify, but to become the first ever IWGP Intercontinental / IWGP Heavyweight Championship. This was, I think, a great match. Tetsuya Naito fighting Jay White. Jay White has been in a really interesting spot here. Naito, of course, trying to fight back his way. They called him. He said he was in the bottom of the ninth. This was his chance to potentially fight his way back into a championship picture. Jay White does have the force of the company behind him. He was the champion coming into this. He was not the champion leaving. Naito gets the win here. What do you think about this match?
Well, the story of these matches, these both the two main events tonight, or the two main events in night one, and then the kind of follow up matches, obviously the Okada Naito match, and then the Ibushi White match is kind of like the loser, the consolation match.
Right.
The story of that match is, Naito had the IWGP Heavyweight Championship match back at Wrestle Kingdom 12 in 2018, and he lost. Right. And a lot of people thought that Naito should have won. A lot of people thought that it was his time. And that it was a loss that kind of hurt his popularity. And you could argue to this day, even though he won tonight, that he still should have won in 2018. But the story is that that failure was what drove Naito for the next 2 years. It chased him. It was a curse that was on his head. He really had to win during this year's Wrestle Kingdom to kind of everything to come full circle to kind of win that. So obviously with Naito beating White and then beating Okada, that's the story, right? You have to fail before you succeed.
Sure.
And I think when we saw with Ibushi over these last two nights, he's now kind of Naito 2 years ago. You could make a case that he should have beat Okada and that he could have been the IWGP champion right now, but he had to fail before he could succeed. And I think that's a key aspect of the storytelling for all of these matches in the main event. I think particularly in the second night's main event, that's a huge part. But here too is that Naito had a lot more to lose than Jay White in this match. If he lost this match, he probably is never going to be IWGP Heavyweight Champion again. But that's a key. I think that is the key story that was kind of unfolded over these last few main events.
Well, and Jay White here, we talked earlier about the connection here to the Bullet Club. Jay White emerging as the leader of the Bullet Club and his position in New Japan, how important he is to them moving forward. But Naito's story is what I think they wanted. The bookers here wanted us to get behind that the most. And you told the story over two nights, right? And these guys had a great match here. The audience was tired, but had a really fun, fast finish.
I thought it was a little difficult coming off of the Ospreay Takahashi match, like sure. for them to get going. They were there by the end, but I think up until about midway through the match, it was kind of like, okay, we need to take a breather. We need to like recuperate, especially because you go from guys wrestling so fast to guys kind of wrestling at a more methodical pace.
Right. And what was the classic New Japan pro wrestling format, which is we go slow before we go fast here, but it gave Naito that credibility in the win on the first night. And of course you mentioned the main event for night one, Okada versus Ibushi having that great run of securing this spot in the G1 climax. And to his thing, if he can overcome and defeat Okada is the golden boy of New Japan Pro Wrestling. He's going to be an Olympic torchbearer in 2020, right? But yet you also had the young gun here, Ibushi. And you know, I think more interesting to me about these two matches, Naito emerging, his story here was really important. But also Ibushi's story, right? Okada is Okada, but Ibushi's been going through a transformation. The G1 was kind of what it felt like, maybe step one. He's not going to win the title. Some people thought he might. I did not think he would. And he did not win the title. But it's the question is for me is what does Ibushi do next? Because the consolation match here on night two, Jay White versus Ibushi, and Ibushi lost again. So that's two major losses coming off of a pretty good year in 2019. His character, it seems like, might be undergoing some kind of change.
Yeah, it's interesting. I thought just based on what we saw the last two nights, I feel like the story might be that Ibushi was like too intense and too vengeful.
Sure.
There was a great spot in this match, the Okada versus Ibushi match, where Ibushi started kicking Okada in the head and then started giving him like these loud open palm strikes to the head. And the crowd started booing him, which is very rare. The crowd rarely boos Ibushi, but the crowd, and this kind of tells you about the Japanese crowd versus the American crowd, is the crowd saw Ibushi basically doing something that was heelish, that was unsportsmanlike, and they didn't like that, and they immediately let him know, like, we don't like that you're doing this.
Yeah.
And I thought that was an interesting touch. I thought the announcers did a great job in this match, in particular the Okada-Ibushi match, because Ibushi would – he'd hit a kick – at a specific time, or he'd do the palm strike and it would sound loud and the announcers would be like talking about something else. And then they would just stop and be like, Oh, like they couldn't believe that, like, oh my God, like I can't believe he hit him that hard. And it really sold that. It wasn't just this guy wasn't just hitting him. He wasn't just kicking him. Like it was anything else. It's like, oh my God, this could end the match right here. And that was really important overall for the structure of the match. But I do think there's something for Ibushi, who's at different times been kind of like presented as being like, carefree, not comedic, but like open to comedy character.
Sure. Well, his run with Kenny Omega was kind of built around that, right?
It's kind of like there's a little like level of goofiness into it, but that's what kind of made him so endearing, was that he was obviously this amazing athlete and this great wrestler, but was also kind of like open to wacky stuff. Sure. And in both of these matches he had at Wrestle Kingdom, he did this fascinating kind of like, it was like, kind of like he was almost like hulking up like Hulk Hogan used to do, but it was like the strong style version of it. Yep. So he was no selling, but he just had this blank expression on his face, but was somehow also like a really telling facial expression. It was really impressive. They just showed him like, he doesn't know where he is. Like, what is he doing? Like, he doesn't feel like he was taking, like he took Okada's drop kick and he just like kind of stood up, or he was taking these forearm blows and he just kind of kept like Terminator walking towards him. It was kind of fascinating to see his character do that. And I don't know how it's going to tie in the future, but I think the obvious comparison is Naito 2 years ago coming up short at Wrestle Kingdom and that kind of fueling him over the next few years, that now Ibushi's on that track. And eventually Ibushi will find himself at the top of the mountain in New Japan. But tonight it wasn't his turn. It was
like, well, it's a continuing story here, right? It's in Naito was the underdog in these two evenings. Ibushi maybe is in 2 years. Before that, it was Kenny Omega was the underdog at one point, and he had to fight his way in multiple times.
He lost at Wrestle Kingdom. He had the draw with
they have a very traditional format to kind of tell the same story with different characters, but it seems to work. And also I think it works because you mentioned the fans. The fans do seem more receptive to traditional pro wrestling storytelling. Here in America, we just kind of want to take ownership over the matches and really express ourselves there. If a good guy does a bad thing, they boo him. And I think that's a really cool factor that plays into the way these matches play out here. Also, Okada here Of course, setting up the match between himself and Naito the next match to have both titles in the same person. But Okada being an Olympic torchbearer, and I just want to ask you, Jesse, can you imagine if this is how big New Japan is to Japan, that one of the major faces, one of the biggest players in this company is going to be a torchbearer for the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. That would be like if we had John Cena as a torchbearer for the Olympics here in America. And I just don't think it's the same level of respect for pro wrestling because of the brands and how different it's portrayed.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of some people in America, it's kind of easy to dismiss the popularity of the New Japan wrestlers in Japan because, like, oh, you know, if they don't draw in America, it doesn't matter. Sure. Which, if you don't watch Japanese wrestling, it doesn't matter to you because you would never hear or see them. But obviously, these guys are extremely popular. I mean, theirs is back to back Tokyo Dome sellouts. That's 80,000 people over 2 days.
Right.
You know, where's WrestleMania's in Tampa Bay this year? So I don't think WrestleMania's going to do 80,000 people. At Tampa Bay, I think the stadium seats about 75 for football, maybe, and probably less for wrestling, but that's beside the point. Point is that they're obviously very popular. And it was actually kind of funny because I saw a lot of people being like, Okada is going to win both titles because he's carrying the Olympic torch and they want to have the champion be the Olympic torch. And I kind of like laughed a little bit when I saw that, because that's exactly what WWE would do. WWE would be like, we have to have the title on this guy because he's carrying the torch and this is big crossover possibility. And I was like, you know, New Japan doesn't think like that. They're going to do what's best for their storylines and their acts. They're not going to be worried about this outside thing. It's great that he was able to do it. And obviously he's a big star. I don't know how many torchbearers there are, like how many people I know, like there's running different legs of it and that kind of stuff, but it's obviously a big honor. Not everyone's going to be able to do it. So it's very interesting. You know, this is a big year for Japan in general with the 2020 Olympics coming up, and that kind of we did on night two. We had the announcements for the the upcoming shows, and they mentioned we kind of knew this already, but they confirmed that the G1 was going to take place in October instead of August. And the general belief on that is because the Olympics are going to be in August, and the Olympics are going to be using a lot of the venues that New Japan normally runs, and that also it's going to kind of gas out all forms of spectator sports or entertainment to be running at the same time as Olympics, because why would you go to night 12 of the G1 if, you know, the Olympic final and
is on the same night
is on the same. Exactly. So it's
my question is, which is tougher to train for? Is it harder to train for the Olympics or is it harder to train for the G1 climax? Because that's a marathon. Right.
Well,
there.
As both an Olympic athlete and a G1 competitor myself. No. Yeah, no, it's, I mean, I was impressed. I mean, tonight, I mean, you saw Naito and Okada and Ibushi and White to wrestle those matches like in basically a 24-hour period. I mean, the conditioning of those guys, the ability to kind of bounce back from taking bumps, it's really, really – that was a huge impressive part of this match, but of the show. But, you know, obviously the main event of night one, I think that was the best match of both shows. It's probably my favorite – probably going to be my match of the year, but obviously it's a little bit early to say that. But. Yeah.
Let's dive into night two just a little bit, because I would have to cover every match, and every match had a huge level of importance here. But there are some big takeaways here. I want to bring up here talking about this conversation about the Olympics, Okada being a torchbearer. Hector Torres brings up wrestling is highly regarded as a sport in Japan versus in the USA, where it's seen more as a form of entertainment. And I think that is the big difference, is we see it as entertainment and they promote it as though it is a legitimate sport. And I just think it's a fascinating difference here. So, of course, again, we had a multi-man match kickoff night two for the Never Open Weight 6-man tag team championship. Not a lot to get into here, but I do think it's important that there's been conversation stateside about having a 6-man title. And I think you see a match like this with all of these different guys involved. We had Evil in it. We had the most violent players in it. I got a bunch of guys too who can be individuals, right? We had Chase Owens in it, Bad Luck Fale. And what a 6-man championship can do, not as though it's its own division, but to involve – WWE does 6-man titles all the time. You can involve other main eventers in those kinds of sequences.
Yeah, I mean, New Japan has all these multi-man tag matches anyway because it's used as a device to get them on the show. We talked about that on night one. So you might as well have some title match on the line. You could argue that, like, the show would have been better if they didn't have this, and instead they had like a Shingo Takagi Tomohiro Ishii singles match that a lot of people wanted to see. Like, yeah, that would be a better match than this kind of gauntlet match, which doesn't really mean that much, but it does mean something. You got to get these guys on the show. There's a lot of people, you know, I'm not ever going to fault New Japan for being like making sure that people who have worked with the company for the full year get a chance to be on the show, even if they're just doing a spot or two. So it's fine to open the show. This kind of replaced the New Japan Rumble. They used to do kind of like a Battle Royal on the pre-show in previous years, but now that they have the six-man titles, they've kind of switched to doing this kind of gauntlet-style match in. It's fine. It's harmless. It gets, you know, everyone comes in.
I do miss the Rumble, though. The Rumble was always fun.
Yeah, they used to, you know, throw in some surprises and stuff like that, and it was kind of cute, but, you know, it's just, you know, this is the replacement for that, but yeah, it's a good, I like the idea of, like, helping legitimize this a little bit by having titles. The titles don't really mean a lot. They kind of switch hands a lot. Nobody really, you know, keeps track of the lineage, you know, outside of like Wikipedia or Cage Match.
The undercard titles maybe don't mean as much, but I think you talk about the main titles mean more. And so I think it is an interesting balance where we have these titles that kind of are a little more propish, but the bigger titles, the IWGP Heavyweight Championship, highly regarded, right?
Oh, one of the big things about this, the takeaways from Wrestle Kingdom, not to compare this to WWE all the time, but like the world title means so much more in New Japan, like the prestige of having it, what it means to have it, what it means to be the guy in the main event every night. Like it kind of makes me sad that WWE's world titles aren't taken quite as seriously. And at one time they totally were, but it just feels like now the title matches kind of feel less important for various reasons. Most of it just comes down to booking, but it does say something that the title is, you know, you could build such a successful two nights of Tokyo Dome Salads based around the titles.
Absolutely. Well, and so that was the course kickoff match. The first major match of the show tonight, or this morning, was the actual Justin Thunder Liger retirement match. Big thing here for me is that Hiromu Takahashi, we were just talking about earlier, he picked up the victory here over Jushin Thunder Liger. And I really thought this was, number one, everybody paid huge amounts of respect to Liger. That's such an incredible thing. I think about Kurt Angle retired earlier this year, and he essentially retired as part of an angle just to make Baron Corbin look a little more sleazy. And here, a huge retiring athlete retiring on a huge stage gets all the respect in the world, even from guys that were his opponents. And I think that is incredible. The big win here for Takahashi. And he even said, Takahashi leaned over at one point and said he promised to carry on Liger's legacy here. So it really did feel like a passing of the torch. And it's such a huge contrast to the way we treated Kurt Angle just, you know, about 10 months ago.
Well, don't say we don't want me into this, Michael. It's WWE that did this. We love Kurt Angle. Liger did the job. It wasn't like he went over just like how Angle did the job, but you're right. There's a degree of respect that comes from, and it almost makes Hiromu feel like a bigger star.
Yes.
That he retired, that he paid respect to him, but then he was like, nah, whatever. I beat that guy. He doesn't mean anything to me, you know, trying to get like some heel heat. It makes it feel like a bigger deal where he's like, thank you for all you've done. I will carry on your legacy. Like it just, especially, I mean, Hiromu was a babyface and Corbin's a heel, so you're going to get that dynamic anyway. But it is an interesting contrast, and I feel like it's almost better to be like, you know, put over the guy that you beat, right? Put over the guy as a legend, as opposed to just being, you know, washed up or anything like that. WWE has a habit of presenting their older wrestlers, with the exception of The Undertaker and Triple H, of course, as kind of being, oh, they're old, they, you know, get beat up by the younger guys, that kind of stuff, as opposed to maybe being respectful, more respectful for them. And in turn, when they do put guys over, it helps them.
Well, again, this is the conversation we had earlier about how guys in New Japan are wrestlers. They're not characters or personas. Mm-hmm. They are just the person, and they may be good or bad. But even like in the States, Baron Corbin, we just kind of see him as being Baron Corbin, the bad guy in WWE, but he's probably somebody else outside of that. And I think it does undermine their ability to do something like this, because Baron Corbin, the TV character, would never pay respect. Whereas Baron Corbin, the human being, even if he's a bad dude, would pay respect. And it's just a huge difference here in mentality. And I think it also, it plays different too, because so often WWE does these kind of post-match beatdowns and attacks and all this kind of stuff. And they do it so frequently that it almost feels like blasé. Whereas in New Japan, there is so much respect shown that when they do one of those angles where somebody is attacked either before or after the match, it feels shocking because it's not overused. And I like that dynamic as well here. Mm-hmm. Good to see Liger kind of go out on a high note here, even though he lost, setting up some success for the future. Next match was I love the entrance here for Roppongi 3K. I think they must have the best entrance music by Rocky Romero in the entire world. I love it. They defeated Bullet Club for the IWGP Junior Heavyweight Tag Team Championship match. And not a whole lot to say here. I think it was a good match, but nothing here that made me think that you know, this is a pivotal match that you have to watch if you're trying to get through both nights pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good match because it shows off the depth that New Japan has, both with Sho and Yo, and obviously El Fantasmo and Taiji Ishimori, where these guys are all like just awesome wrestlers, and they're just like other guys in the card. But sure, this was a good junior heavyweight division. Tag division's always usually pretty good. Fast pace, a lot of pin attempts, a lot of breakup of pins, that kind of stuff, high spots, all stuff that you would want to see. It was a good sprint, is what they would call it. About 12 minutes in length, just real good, solid wrestling. Is it something that you absolutely have to see because it'll blow you away? No, but if you like good wrestling, and it's a really good part of the show if you just like solid performing.
Speaking of good part of the show, Sonata versus Zack Sabre Jr. for the RevPro British mm-hmm. Heavyweight Championship. Dude, what a match this was. Of course, if you don't know, Zack Sabre Jr., notorious for his strong style, or as he calls it, his Sabre-style wrestling. And this was just a very great grappling style. We're going to be on the mat. We're going to roll through everything. You know, it's guys flipping into and out of moves, this catch-style wrestling. And you know, what I liked about it is they talked about Zack Sabre's training style, what made mm-hmm. him unique. They say that every time Sonata has won at Wrestle Kingdom, he's won gold. And so there were all these dynamic stories coming into this. And this match, I think this match was only, it was only about 12 minutes. But it was just a really great 12 minutes of wrestling that you didn't see anywhere else over these two nights.
Yeah, Zack is so useful because his style is so different that you can have a match like the junior tag team championship match, which is, you know, fast paced tag team, junior heavyweight tag match. It's going to be guys going fast. Zack comes in and it's slow, but I mean, some people say he's boring, which I can understand if you think he's boring, but I think on a show like this, his style is so different with, you know, the tricky roll ups and the various submissions. He always wins his matches either by a new roll up form or a different submission. You never know right when a match is going to end. Anytime he locks in a submission could be the end of the match. Anytime he goes for a roll up, it could be the end of the match. Psychologically, he's perfect. I think they can do anything with him. I think they wanted to push him. Right now, he's kind of in the mid card. They wanted to push him in the main event. I feel like he could do that. He's also like low key, a great heel. And I really like his banter. Like we talked about the match the previous night, the 8-man tag, and they were kind of Suzuki Gun with Zack. We're kind of going at it with Sonata, and like Zack's kind of got the title. And he's like, "You'll never get this. You'll never get this." And he turns around and he's like, "All right, how about a beer?" And he's got like a British accent. He just feels like, just like, he's just like so snobbish. It's perfect. He does a really good job with his just character. And another great thing about the commentary is that Zack is obviously very skinny. And most people would say, like, this guy's too skinny to be a wrestler. But the commentary talks about how that helps his wrestling style when he comes in with all these holds. Sonata can't get him in this lock because his arms are too loose, because he's too skinny. He can slide out of stuff. He can apply stuff. He's very, like, lean. And it really, like, is perfect commentary because you're taking what should be a weakness and marketing it as a strength.
Right.
And that's like, something, it seems simple, but it's rarely done. And I just think overall this is great. This is, like you said, it's a really good match, and it's different than the other stuff on the show, which helps.
Well, they make it believable. To your point, they mm-hmm. make it seem like it's a thing that can actually happen. CM Punk said this a few weeks ago when he was on WWE Backstage. Fans want believability in their pro wrestling, and I think the way the announced team builds this up, it is. Also, we talk about this style, and again, I don't know if somebody can consider this boring. If every match was this style of ground-based grappling, maybe, but the speed at which they were going through some of this and the back and forth and the constant near falls, I thought was super interesting. I mean, there were some like holds in there, but that's just part of the game because you got to have that pace every once in a while to give the fans a chance to breathe. But what made it really cool was the win. I wasn't going to say it came out of nowhere, but the win kind of came out of very suddenly. But they made that believable because there was so much jockeying for position, so many transitions into and out of pin attempts that whenever Zack Sabre Jr. pulled off the victory at the end, it seemed like he could very easily have caught Sonata by surprise if they were actually real fighting. And I just love that. I loved everything about that finish, and you should check it out.
Yeah. And on top of that, Michael, it trains the fans to next time they wrestle, next time Zack goes for a roll up, the fans will think that's a near fall, believable near fall, as opposed to a guy just doing a roll up. It's all about training the fans. And we'll get into that. There was a very key moment in the main event between Okada and Naito where that came into play. But if you train the fans to expect different finishes, more stuff works. It's one of the reasons that I really like AEW is trying to do that. They don't have the reputation quite there. But one of the reasons I like when they do 20-minute draws, I like when they do Countouts. I like when you do kind of different stuff like that because you have to train the fans to expect these things. So when you tease them, they actually work. And yep. I think that's really important.
Well, and not only are you training the fans here to kind of understand how this works, you're helping them understand that there's a variety of things they can watch and experience in pro wrestling that may not be what they're used to, but it can still be very effective. And so WWE leans into the same style too often. And I think when you have pay-per-views, it gets really dull because we just know what's going to play out here. And again, check this match out if it's one of the ones you're watching this week, if only because it is something so different. Now, we have a few more matches here on night two that are worth talking about here. John Moxley coming in, IWGP United States Championship, regaining it on night one, defending it on night two against Juice Robinson. I was not crazy about this match. I did not feel like at any point that Moxley was in real danger of losing the championship. We saw a little rougher edge to Juice Robinson in certain parts of this match, but I thought it was just a fine match. The bigger thing here for me, Moxley retaining going back to AEW this week, but then moving on as your IWGP US title holder for the near future.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it does say, that he's going to keep working for New Japan. There was some talk that maybe he would stop working after this were kind of his last dates, but obviously it's going to be interesting because New Japan is going to be running about 25 shows in the US in 2020. It's a big year for them in the US. Famously, because Moxley did not wrestle on the G1 show in the US, the idea was that Moxley could wrestle for New Japan in Japan, but in the US, he was exclusive to AEW, and he's the US champion. Is he not going to be able to appear on those shows? But we can talk about this during the Jericho Tanahashi match. There's obviously a lot of balls in the air between the AEW and New Japan relationship. If things have changed, if things haven't changed, if things are better, if things are worse, we don't know for sure. But it's interesting that he retained the title. The more important aspect of this match is forget about the match. Match is whatever. After the match, Minoru Suzuki comes out and challenges Moxley for the title, which is a match that I never thought, I didn't think I wanted, but now I absolutely need. It's interesting how they use Suzuki, because during the first night when they had the Suzuki Gun 8-man tag, Suzuki was there, but he didn't really do anything. They came out to Zack Sabre Jr.'s music instead of Suzuki's, which is odd and frankly disappointing because Suzuki's theme song is awesome. But it was presented as being like Zack is the star. Suzuki is just this other guy. And, you know, he's over 50 years old. So you would assume that maybe it's time that Zack kind of takes the reins as the main star and Suzuki's kind of fades into the background. No, of course, tonight Suzuki comes out with his music. He challenges John Moxley. After Moxley beat Lance Archer for the title, he said he was going big game hunting, which was alluding to maybe the IWGP Heavyweight Championship. Turns out he's probably talking about Suzuki, because Suzuki comes out, challenges Moxley for the title, says if he wins the title, he's going to be the King of America. I don't want to be too political on this, but I'm here for the Minoru Suzuki monarchy, Suzuki 2020. but I don't think that's how it works. I don't think if you win the US title, you're the King of America. I'd have to double check.
I don't think that's how it works, though. But it's more of that. But I think that is interesting because he was bragging so much after the match and kind of disrespecting New Japan. And I thought it was so awesome that Suzuki was the guy to answer that call. And it felt very personal and very real and gave them a reason to fight beyond just having the championship.
And as soon as he came out, I was like, I'm here for this. Wherever I'm take, like, what's the meme? Shut up and take my money. Like, that's what it is. Like, oh, Suzuki versus Moxley. I'm here for that. So that's really what this, I mean, the Juice versus Moxley match isn't super important, but the post match is what I think people will be talking about.
Absolutely. We had Hiroki Goto defeating Kenta. Of course, if you guys know Kenta, former NXT star, they mentioned that this is the first time that he had wrestled in Wrestle Kingdom since, what was that? For his first Tokyo Dome singles appearance, I should say, since 2005. Of course, he spent a few years in NXT. This was a good match. It was for the NEVER Openweight Championship. Kenta, coming in the champion, did lose to Hiroki Goto. Not much here for me to really dig into. What were your thoughts on this match, Jesse?
I really liked the match. It was kind of a basic, strong, very most strong style of all the matches we saw. It was just, the ending was just Goto just clotheslined him and beat him down and ended up winning the title. The storyline here, I'll have to summarize it briefly, is that Katsuri Shibata, who was a former New Japan wrestler who suffered a devastating brain injury and can no longer wrestle, very good friends with Goto and also good friends with Kenta. And when Kenta left WWE, Shibata kind of got him into New Japan because Kenta didn't wrestle for New Japan previously. Right. He wrestled for Pro Wrestling Noah. So Shibata's like, here, open the door for Kenta to get into New Japan. And that's real life. That's a real story. And then they did a storyline last year where when Kenta joined the Bullet Club, he disrespected Shibata. He actually like beat down Shibata, which was stunning at the time because Shibata, we were told basically Shibata can't take any bumps because he had a significant brain injury. And then so this was Goto out for revenge on his friend, kind of, you know, being a surrogate for Shibata and gaining that kind of vengeance, which is why you kind of had this heated match. Kenta, since he's come back to New Japan, has kind of been hit or miss. When he's in a singles match, he's really good. When he's not in a singles match, he just completely absent, doesn't right. really do much for me.
Yeah, it's like he's not interested. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I saw him, I got a chance to see him live, and it was just like one of the house shows they ran in the US this summer. And it's like, oh, I was excited to see him because you hadn't, you know, see. Oh, Kenta, he's kind of still new at the time, and he like did nothing in the match.
Well, just and you talk about like he was in NXT, and then he had injury, and then he wasn't there anymore. Mm-hmm. And part of that, people said maybe he wasn't as interested in his storylines. He when he's not involved or invested, it just seems like he checks out a little bit.
Yeah, he did. He checked out, but tonight he brought it because he had a big singles match.
Yes.
And this was a. I feel like if you aren't familiar with Strong Style, watch this match because that's really what it was. It was hard hitting. There's no nonsense. Just guys. You know, beating the crap out of each other. Goto just ended up kind of beating him down at the end and winning the match. It's a good match to watch. It's not that long, but it was good for what it was.
Yeah, yeah. No, nothing wrong here. The Strong Style was shown throughout it. And again, the difference here between this and a Zack Sabre Jr. match, which is what I love, which is guys in these kinds of matches win by beating the hell out of their opponent until they just can't fight anymore. A Zack Sabre Jr. match, he wins by timing and getting the right roll up, and I love that contrast here. Of course. The big match we had, I was not a big fan of having this match on this card. The loser match from night one, Jay White and Kota Ibushi. I thought maybe they should have saved this for we have New Year's Dash coming up tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Like we should have saved that and it could have been a number one contendership for the IC title again or something like that.
Well, I believe this match is like a de facto number one contenders match for the IWGP championship.
Is it? Because I never quite picked up on it. Did they say that on the announcement?
That's my impression.
They said that they were going to fight their way back into contention, but it never felt like it was quite that open. Right. Either way.
Maybe that just implied that like, that's been like, if you win this match, you'll be put out the front of the line for the title. But anyway, I understand your point that this maybe could have been saved for another match, but again, it is Wrestle Kingdom. It's their version of WrestleMania. They got two nights for it. You kind of go all out. You don't.
Well, and we're doing a third night, basically. New Year's Dash always comes immediately after WrestleMania. So they haven't even announced that card yet. They're going to announce it when the bell starts tomorrow night.
Well, historically, New Year's Dash, is usually like kind of like it's kind of like the Raw after WrestleMania.
Yes.
Very similar to that, but the main focus of New Year's Dash is kind of like Wrestle Kingdom is over. Here are the new feuds.
Right.
And that's where they'll start. So yeah, they usually don't go crazy with like a big main event for that show. I know this year it's in a bigger venue just because historically New Year's Dash has been like impossible to get tickets for because it takes place at Korakuen Hall, which only has about 1,800 seats. And it comes the day after you just sold 40,000 seats and all these people are around for Tokyo Dome, but they moved into a bigger building. So it's going to be like one of their actually biggest shows of the year from an attendance standpoint, but it's probably just going to be a little tag match. But anyway, this was the de facto number one contenders, loser consolation match, third place match, whatever you want to call it.
And we talked a lot about Ibushi before, so I don't think we need to retread all that. The one thing I want to bring up about this match that I think is fascinating is this match was the first one that had a lot of like kind of chaos involved. And I mean that not as the group, but as in just general match anarchy, right? There was the ref got knocked out twice. We had an unprotected chair shot whenever they threw one. Ibushi got hit directly in the head when a chair got thrown at him. So there was kind of all this anarchy happening in the ring, and I think it worked because they didn't really do this throughout any other match. There were a couple of small things here and there, but this match had more run-ins and things like that, and it was more effective because it hadn't been overused anywhere else throughout the two nights of New Japan. Also, you know what I love about New Japan Pro Wrestling too? The referees are characters, not in the way that we used to have Earl Hebner and Nick Patrick as like referee characters who fought at pay-per-views, but you know Red Shoes, you know all the different referees. This one referee, right, for example, he stands more for keeping the match under control, and I think that also adds an element of credibility to what happens at these shows.
Yeah, I wasn't a big fan of the interference this match. It was actually kind of disappointing to me. I thought the match was fine. And I was fine with White going over. It tells the story Ibushi failed twice at Wrestle Kingdom. So that sets that story up. And White gets a big win over Ibushi. So Bullet Club has something. This is one of the only matches they won. I think it might have been it's the only match they won, I believe.
The only match they won, yes.
Yeah, which is something. And but I just thought the constant interference was a little unnecessary. It kind of felt cheap that there's interference in this very important match.
But I just didn't see this match as being important, I guess. And again, I thought this was just, it felt a little bit more like filler. If there is something on the line, I get it. But because it didn't feel important to me, I was like, yeah, sure. Let's just throw in the kitchen sink. That'd be fine.
Yeah. I mean, New Japan, one thing about New Japan is that they don't do singles matches that much. It's mostly tag matches. So anytime there's a singles match, it kind of has a certain level of importance, especially if it's a singles match between two big stars at Wrestle Kingdom. I do get what you're saying, that maybe this wasn't as important of a match, but I just felt like you could have done the match without the interference. You could have told the same story. White would look better for it. I know part of the idea is he got a bunch of heel heat by cheating, but yeah. To me, it just kind of like felt unnecessary, but that's just my opinion.
I would love to see White come stateside at some point. I think he would be an amazing leader of a heel faction in maybe something like AEW, right? Could you imagine if in a couple of years Jericho is stepping away and we have the Inner Circle and they need a new guy to step up and be their leader, and it's somebody like a Jay White? I mean, that's just me fantasy.
I mean, White's really interesting because I think he was pushed a little too fast in New Japan. He wasn't quite ready for this role. But if you watch him, he's a really good wrestler. He's 27 years old. He's got tons of potential. Yeah. It's hard for me to say that he's not deserving of his push right now because he does execute when he needs to. I just don't feel like from like a personality standpoint, he's as over as some of the other people that he's ahead, such as Will Ospreay. But I do think that there's, you know, the sky's the limit for him. I saw someone toss out the idea that what if Jay White was the leader of the Dark Order, which would be pretty interesting. I don't know how effective that would be, but it's just an idea, but you're right. It was kind of a guy who could come into the U.S. one day.
I don't think we need to break down Jay White with maybe saddling him with that New Order stuff at this point. So we had, of course, this was living in the shadow of our big co-main event, the first match being Chris Jericho versus Hiroshi Tanahashi. Jericho was not putting his AEW World Championship on the line, but he promised that if he lost to Tanahashi, Tanahashi could request an AEW World Championship match. I like this match. They got a good 20 to 30 minutes. Jericho, you know, he's not in bodybuilder shape here. He doesn't look as good as the six packs of Ibushi or even the kind of prototypical bodybuilder style we see in WWE. Mm-hmm. But New Japan focuses more on that fight style and that fight body. And Jericho does fit in from that perspective here. He got a little winded in spots of this match. But overall, I thought this was the exact kind of match it needed to be. And Jericho goes over with the win using, and I got to call this out here, not only did he use his typical Walls of Jericho Boston Crab to get the victory, he leaned in and went full on lion tamer with it. And the announcement he put over here, that's got to be humiliating for Tanahashi because all the young lions learn about this exact move and their role since it's called the Lion Tamer. So I just love that little bit too.
Historically, Lion, like if you watch a Young Lions match, but just between the Young Islands, it almost always ends in a Boston Crab. That's all it moves. So the idea was, yeah, that was a great job by Kevin Kelly pointing out, because I wasn't even thinking about that. I'm like, oh yeah, that is the young boy move. I mean, the shadow over this match is that if Tanahashi won, he would get an AEW title match, which would signify probably more New Japan involvement with AEW and vice versa. Instead, with Jericho winning, it makes it seem like that this was just kind of used as a prop for to help people get more interested in the match. And it worked because I was much more interested in this match because I had that kind of like, you know, if Tanahashi wins, then all of a sudden, you know, that means something else for AEW and New Japan. But alas, Jericho still won. He did come out with the title. He kind of teased like he didn't have the title belt because people were talking like, oh, do you think Jericho will wear the title to the ring? And he comes out wearing the jacket and the t-shirt. I'm like, oh, he's not wearing the title. That's interesting because they reference the title a bunch and then he takes off his shirt. And of course, he has the title on. Jericho and Tanahashi are, and I feel 100% confident in saying this, are the two smartest people in professional wrestling. Mm. They are... like, this isn't like a match athletically that you're going to see with these other, you know, like obviously the main event or, you know, Ospreay and Hiromu and that kind of stuff.
Right.
Because these guys are older. They've wrestled a million matches. They've taken a ton of bumps. Both guys are pretty beat up. But they could have a good match if they were both in wheelchairs because they understand how to work the crowd.
Yeah.
Jericho, you can tell, really likes working in Japan. There's a certain novel aspect he gets from interacting with the crowd there where he kind of does a lot of just what would maybe be like obnoxious, like not very interesting heel stuff in the US, but just like flipping off the crowd and yelling at them and doing all this kind of like basic heel stuff, but it really gets a reaction.
Showboating over there, I think this is what's interesting.
Yeah, showboating.
I think that like Jericho needs to have a slower pace of match because he's not in the shape he was 20 years ago.
Yeah, he's not going to have a good, you know, if he was going to be doing flips and stuff like that, that's not what he's going to do well.
But that showboating is something you don't see a lot from guys in Japan, to the extent that Jericho gets the top rope and does the guitar riff. And he's so good at it that, of course, I want him to do it in that crowd. And he gets the reaction. And it's just a great kind of full circle experience.
This was the best match of the weekend, based on like you have someone who's obviously the heel and who's obviously the baby face. With Naito and Okada, you had Naito was ended up being the baby face and Okada the heel, but that's a different dynamic. This was very much Jericho was the classic evil heel and Tanahashi is the classic lovable baby face. And they're both so smart at working. Tanahashi's the perfect working baby face. Jericho's the perfect working heel. And it really works. If you were like a fan of just traditional wrestling, this is going to be your favorite match probably on the show, just because the basics were there and they did an excellent job and they went a pretty good distance. I mean, Tanahashi was actually in really good shape. He had been, you know, he's been banged up for years and he actually didn't even have, they had this New Japan bodybuilding contest that Tanahashi kind of like, put together with the guys, just like, hey, everyone try to get in as really good shape as possible. So you can tell that he was in good shape. I saw Jericho. I'm like, man, Jericho like doesn't look like he's in great shape, which is, you know, when I'm 49, I won't look in that good shape either.
That's right.
He still can do everything he needs to do to be effective. So he's not out there botching stuff. He's not out there like getting so winded that the match has to be short to hide his weaknesses. He can still get it done enough in the ring to justify always being in the main event, because everything else is there from the promos and the charisma and the name value and all that kind of stuff.
He still hits the big spots when he needs to. He had a great drop kick to the outside at one point. And so I just think he still does enough right that it clicks. So we talk about here, what does this mean, right? If Tanahashi had won, that he would be in line possibly to get an AEW title shot. And that might more importantly signify that AEW and New Japan had come to some sort of working deal, especially with Moxley walking out with the IWGP United States Championship. Well, it does not look like that is officially the case. In the post-match press conference, Chris Jericho did address this. Somebody asked him about it. He said that he would love to see, he did not say it's happened, but he said he would love to see a stronger working relationship between these two companies. He almost made it seem like the bad blood that has been rumored for a while maybe is not quite as bad, or something they could not possibly work through. So that's good to hear. And he also said he expects to be back at next year's Wrestle Kingdom as well. So some hope there for the fans. I've said it before. I think both of these companies almost, I don't need each other, but I think especially New Japan needs AEW to gain a bigger foothold in the American audience. They tried it with Ring of Honor. That partnership fizzled because of a lot of factors. I think AEW would be a better partner for New Japan. And I think AEW would also get a rub from being next to all of these IWGP, the heavyweight championship, the US title, which have this historic backstory to them.
Yeah. I mean, it's makes logical sense for them to benefit. There's some bad blood and I get it on both sides. If you watch the, I don't know if you saw it, but it was the wrestlers ordering room service with the Young Bucks and then Kenny Omega. And they don't really talk about anything specific, but they talk about their exits both from Ring of Honor and New Japan. And there's clearly a lot of tension there. And so it's more difficult than I think most people think, but at the same time, eventually they should be able to work out the differences. And like I said, when I tweeted this out, as soon as the match was over, I'm like, all right, everyone, you know, forget about your fantasy booking ideas. It's going to be a little while, because as soon as people, you know, get their imaginations going, like, ooh, you know, what if they work together? What if, you know, Okada comes over and he challenges someone for the title, and then you do Okada and Omega in the US, or, you know, Sammy Guevara goes over and is part of the Best of the Super Juniors tournament, or, you know, so-and-so is in the G1 and, you know, this kind of stuff like that, all this kind of stuff, which maybe will happen one day. And I hope it does, because as wrestling fans, I think we'd be the big winners from their working relationship.
Absolutely. So we have our main event here, of course, set up for the previous night. It is Tetsuya Naito, the new IWGP Intercontinental Championship, defending it / fighting for Kazuchika Okada's IWGP Heavyweight Championship. And this match was, these guys wrestled killer matches the night before. This match was a killer match. I see lots of people saying it's going to be one of their matches of the years. Naito winning by just a great offensive flurry down the stretch. And I just think this was exactly what it needed to be. It went about 35 minutes. We got to see Okada continuously. He's telling the story here of him trying to hit that Rainmaker over and over and over again, and he can't quite do it. He finally hits it. Naito still kicks out. Naito, bottom of the ninth, finding a way to win against all odds. And what I liked about it, too, was Okada is, we talked about this earlier, he is the consummate New Japan Pro Wrestling golden boy, right? He is the guy that that company upholds like none other. And so to get the fans to turn against him is challenging. But what they did was Okada worked the knee throughout this match, and it gained sympathy for Naito. You talked earlier, Naito maybe didn't have quite the same fan base he had since losing a couple of years ago. And they told that story in the match as well. Mm-hmm. But him getting worked over by Okada, getting that nasty spot where he's dropped onto a table with his knee, it really started getting the fans behind him, so that down the stretch when Naito made his big kind of fight back into this to get the win, the fans were solidly there with him. And it was just a great finish to a great two nights of wrestling. I don't know that I would say this match was as good as what I think some of the Omega Okada matches were. Like, those were some fantastic bouts, but this was a pretty damn good match.
I thought this was great. I thought that, were they as good as the Omega matches? I mean, I would probably say no, but that's an unfair standard.
Sure, sure.
But I thought they did a lot of good stuff in here. I liked, you had the great story of, you know, Naito had been driven for 2 years to come back and avenge his loss. They told the story about how he, you know, he did this interview with New Japan's website where he talked about how he thought about retiring because he's like, I don't know if I can wrestle anymore. You know, I'm banged up, this kind of stuff. Classic story, guy loses, has all this self-doubt, thinks about quitting, but ends up rallying back, accomplishes his dreams, pulled, you know, over these two nights. I really liked the table spot with the knee, because yeah. I think there's a couple things that go into that. The first is that it's just different. We see table spots a lot in every single wrestling promotion. And while everyone likes table spots, they always get over. A lot of them are kind of the same. It's either someone dives on top of someone on the table or someone gets put through the table. This was a little different. He gave him what is essentially like an atomic drop or like a shin breaker on the table. So he like didn't like put him right through the table, but he like jammed his knee on the table, and it still looked good, but it was just different than how you would do a normal table spot. And then the second thing is they did this count out spot that was so good, because if you were to think about it as a wrestling fan, you're like, well, there's no way they're going to do a count out finish. There's no way that Naito gets counted out in the main event of Wrestle Kingdom 14 night two with both titles on the line. And this is how it ends for Naito. He gets counted out because he got dropped on a table. Like, but when they're doing the count out and, you know, the referee says 17 and Naito's trying to get back in and he falls down, I'm like, oh my God, he's going to get counted out. And of course he rallies back, and just getting me, convincing me that it could legitimately be a finish, even though in the back of my head, I'm like, there's no way this is actually the finish. Sure. That's really good storytelling. And it comes from having done countouts before in matches, that you teach the crowd to actually expect that, as opposed to just being something you have to do if wrestlers go outside the ring.
Like WWE tends to do most of the time. They rarely have count out wins or losses, right?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of promotions are like that. It's not just WWE, but you're right. Like, counting out is something that you have to do things from time to time. Like, there was I think it was Bad Luck Fale and Zack Sabre Jr. They did a great count out in last year's G1. And the whole point, the reason it was so good was because you don't do count outs a lot, but if you do it every once in a while, it teaches the fans to understand that. Obviously they didn't do the count out here. I just thought it was a really interesting spot.
Yeah. And one of our commenters says if Naito would have gotten counted out, that place would have turned into one night stand.
Yeah. Like, there's no way they would actually do the count out spot. Right. But I just, right, the fact that they were able to convince me, a cynical wrestling fan, that they could actually do it was really impressive. And like you said, there was a great flurry of finishes at the end.
I mean, we talked about the count out spot, but that Poison Rana, that thing was sick. It was an incredible move. And of course, I just love this. Naito hitting the Stardust Press looked amazing.
Well, he had the story of that move is, first of all, the story of Naito is that was his original finisher, or his finisher when he first kind of got Naito was kind of pushed 5 or 6 years ago as like kind of a white meat baby face. Yeah. And the crowd never quite took to him. He went to Mexico. He joined Los Ingobernables, kind of developed this anti-hero persona. He comes back much more popular, really cracked through at the main event level, that the, you know, especially after Nakamura left, as kind of like the anti-hero guy in New Japan. But he had never really gotten this. He had won the title before in kind of a brief 60-day reign that is very forgettable. It's almost worse that it's almost like not even worth talking about. But this was his chance to do it. And the fact that in 2018, he went for the Stardust Press and he missed it. And he lost the match.
And that's how he lost the match, yes.
Because the announcers brought that up. So the fact that he hit it, I thought that could be the finish. Because it's like, oh, he had to go back to what made him great, you know, 5 or 6 years ago before he was, you know, Tranquilo.
Right.
To end up getting that big win. And of course it was another good near fall, but it was just a lot of different kind of psychological elements. People who don't watch New Japan might say that New Japan lacks storytelling or lacks psychology. And I find it completely the opposite. And you look at a match like this, it's all storytelling. Okada is, I said in my preview column I wrote before these events that I thought Ibushi Naito should be the main event night two, because Ibushi should get a chance to win the title even if he loses it. You can still do the vengeance storyline, but he doesn't look like a total loser losing the two matches back to back. But while I was watching the match, I'm like, it makes sense. Okada, like you said, Okada is the standard bearer for New Japan. He's the guy that if you want to really be the guy in New Japan, you have to beat him. You can't beat someone else for the title. It has to be Okada. And it really worked like that. He is Ric Flair. I mean, when it comes to being the guy that just night in, night out, he's the guy that has the title matches. He's the guy. He's going to be the champion again at some point. I'm sure Naito will get a decent run with the title this time. But it's still – the company still revolves around Okada, and you understand why. Because the performances he puts on, his knowledge, the way he puts together his finishes, the last 3 or 4 minutes of Okada matches are the best parts of wrestling.
Absolutely.
And we saw that both in the Ibushi match and the Naito match, which were two different kind of matches, but just those flurries, the Rainmaker. And the other thing about him, I'm just gushing about Okada, but he just does simple stuff. He does a clothesline and he does a drop kick and he does the tombstone pile driver. But he just gets so much out of those moves. It's not like he's doing crazy spots or athletic moves or moves that are going to kill him or kill his opponent if he does them too much. They're really basic stuff, but just his knowledge of timing and execution and getting stuff over. He just does simple stuff and it works. And that's how you show. That's how you understand like true genius in wrestling, is when you can do that kind of stuff and it gets over.
Well, I think that's the story of New Japan in general, is they don't have to do – I mean, they do some really tough, brutal stuff.
Yeah.
But they make it feel real because of things like timing, because of the way that guys sell moves afterwards. The way they go for pinfalls, I don't always have to scoop the head and raise the leg, right? I can just fall on top of you because that's where you naturally fell, and I think that adds to the element of realism. So I dig all of that. Yeah, this is – I mean, again, and that's Wrestle Kingdom 14 in a nutshell. This is a great creator. Yeah.
Real quick, just to kind of summarize, what did you think about the two-night format?
I dug it. If we'd have to do this podcast in the middle of the night, I think it would have been better, right? But I wish I got to think, you know, maybe WrestleMania should be two nights. But they already do NXT on that Saturday night, so it'd be hard to split. But I did overall think it was a really great way to tell the story in a complete fashion.
Yeah, I liked having the two nights back-to-back. I thought that, like, the junior heavyweight title match maybe doesn't get as much time as it did.
Sure.
It was only one show. I'm kind of a pro WrestleMania two night person. You would have to tweak the schedule a little bit, but WWE's whole idea is they want to dominate WrestleMania weekend. They don't like that these other promotions show up and steal fans from them. So if you have another night of WrestleMania, you're going to kind of muscle out those other fans, because then you have NXT. You can still do NXT.
Right.
Maybe sacrifice the Hall of Fame or do the Hall of Fame at a different time of year or something like that. But I think it's too obvious. You get a second gate, which is huge. And I think the number one complaint from WrestleMania these last few years has been the show's too long. So you cut it down. You make the show more manageable to watch. The fans don't get exhausted. I mean, it depends. WWE has a ridiculous amount of roster depth, so they could put together 20 matches, two 10-match cards or two 8-match cards or whatever you wanted to do, and it could be good. I think it's interesting that they were able to basically double, because there's talk about whether New Japan's going to do this next year, because this year it worked out because it kind of fell naturally on a weekend because you had the Friday night and Saturday night shows. Next year it's going to be a little more tricky because the second show is going to be a Sunday night show, or it's going to be a Monday show, or I forget how the calendar works. It's hard.
Yeah, these have been in the Fridays in the past, so it's not always easy. I think that WWE could do it now. It's different this year anyway because they're doing Hall of Fame on Thursday, SmackDown's on Friday. So they have shows. Right,
SmackDown on Friday.
So you have SmackDown on Friday and Raw on Monday, so that whole weekend is kind of bookended by TV shows. But what I think you would do if you're WWE is, and I love NXT, and I think TakeOver is always so special, but I think you swap that to be night one of WrestleMania, and maybe it's headlined by your NXT championship, and you save the WWE or it's headlined by the SmackDown WWE Championship and the Raw WWE Championship on night two. But I would think that you could still do it. And I would honestly rather see another night of WrestleMania and see that card spread out and lose TakeOver and get some of that TakeOver talent and those matches on a WrestleMania card.
Hypothetically, what I would do, and I don't know if you can do this, obviously, you do TakeOver Thursday night. You do Hall of Fame is on SmackDown, or you don't do Hall of Fame. Hall of Fame's stupid. It's sometimes entertaining to see the guys talk. It's usually on too long. Yeah. They're out of relevant people to put in, so they kind of just induct the same people over and over again in different versions. Right. I'm very anti WWE Hall of Fame. So if you wanted to do, or you could do that a different time of year. You don't have to do it during WrestleMania year either. That's like their own rule. I'm just thinking
weekend before, like the All Star Game is the weekend after Super Bowl, right? Or do it the weekend after
Pro Bowl,
like,
or
the Pro Bowl, I guess. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, do it different places, right? Like
you can do it whenever, and it just seems like a no-brainer. Like you're literally gonna make, I mean, maybe ticket prices go down a little bit, but you're gonna be making double the gate,
right?
In theory, right? And you control WrestleMania week. You're not gonna have people going to the Saturday night other shows, because you know, as good as TakeOver is on those Saturday nights, it's not gonna be like a they can only fit 14,000 people or whatever in the arena, as opposed to, so those other people are gonna find other shows. I just think it makes kind of sense to do it on two nights. I don't know if they'll do it. It's never been two nights before. Yeah. But I think
it'd be great.
This was an interesting experiment, having it over two nights. I thought it was interesting because they really used it to tell stories. And that
continues throughout both nights.
Yeah. Like you kind of, if you wanted the full experience, you needed to watch both nights. You couldn't just watch, you know, one night or whatever there was. And there wasn't one night that was better than the other. I thought night one had better top tier matches, but there was the first part of the card that you didn't really need to watch. The second night had a little bit more title matches. It was a little more of a consistent show from top to bottom. But I thought it worked out. They pulled it off very nicely, and it'd be interesting to see if WWE attempts something similar.
Well, if you didn't watch Wrestle Kingdom 14, it is in the books. This was New Japan Pro Wrestling's biggest event of the year. If you didn't watch it, we just spoiled every match for you, right? But you can check it out. The replay is on Fight, the Fight.tv. There's a Fight app on Roku. Lots of, it's all on Android phones, all that jazz. Great broadcast from them. Thank you guys again for sending us those codes that we got to send out to our fans. So Fight is a place to check it out. If you have a subscription to New Japan Pro Wrestling World, you can watch it on there as well. And I would highly encourage you go check out these cards, because they're just something different. If you've not watched Japanese wrestling, this is a great place to get started. So that being said, 10 hours of wrestling in the book, an hour and a half podcast in the book. Jesse, where can people find you? I know you do a lot for Wrestling Inc. You write a lot of articles. You do that View from the Turnbuckle series. Where can people catch up with your work for Wrestling Inc.?
Yep, you can check out Views from the Turnbuckle pretty much every Friday. Uploads Friday mornings on Wrestling Inc. You can also follow me on Twitter. That's at Jesse Collings, just like my number, or just like my name. Jeez, that was bad. I'm very tired. Just like my name, at Jesse Collings on Twitter.
Well, Jesse, thank you so much for joining. If you guys did like our podcast tonight, please give us a rating on iTunes for the audio version. Give us that thumbs up on YouTube for the video version. We don't always do New Japan stuff, but if we find out you guys like it, we are more likely to do more of it. So call it out in the comments. Tell us what you think about this. We appreciate those of you who did join us for this early morning show. My name, I am Michael Wiseman. I am on Twitter at The Real Wiseman. Wrestling Inc. will be back tomorrow night, immediately following Raw, for their post-game show there. That will be Glenn, and maybe Raj is back from vacation. I don't know. Matt Morgan will be there. Maybe Justin LaBar shows up. Who knows? Tune in to find out. Excuse me. Anyway, thank you all for joining us. We will catch you right here next time at Wrestling Inc. In broadcast.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.